and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 8th, 2023. The global carbon dioxide level is 419.46 parts per million, and there are only 2,519 days left until the year 2030. Well, today what we'll do is cross-post another show from with our friends at Franklin Matters. What we'll be talking about is a fancy word called decarbonization, but some relatively simple things you can do about it, and how, sort of philosophically, how you learn about these things. I hope you enjoy. So decarbonization sounds fancy, but it's really the kind of the whole process of trying to replace the fossil fuels with clean energy.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM dial at 102.9. Here today for another Making Sense of Climate session with my guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, happy Tuesday to you, sir.
Happy Tuesday to you right back at you. Fun to enter our second year of recording on this. That's pretty amazing, but there you go.
You know, it's a roadmap we're following, and fortunately, we know the direction. We don't know how we're going to get there.
That's right.
No pun intended. This is our second session in this new calendar year, 2023, and there were a flurry of kind of year-end reports and recaps. And I know, if I recall correctly, when we had Jeff Roy on previously, he mentioned he was waiting for this Commission on Clean Heat report, which did indeed get issued on November 30th, and I think it missed our radar to talk last time. But it was interesting because if I recall correctly, maybe shift over here, the first two paragraphs, which are really only like five or six sentences, but you know, governmental sentences, they kind of like a run on, and I understand why they're doing that. So I will read it a little bit slower to make some sense of it, so to speak. I quote, "To comply with Mass Law and achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. The Commonwealth needs to rapidly," emphasis there on mine, "rapidly scale up decarbonization efforts within the residential and commercial building sector." I'll skip ahead. There's clues. A whole wide range of factors, single family, residential, homeowners, large family, large multifamily, landlords, tenants, yada, 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 yada. Coordinated actions, emphasis, coordinated actions will need to occur across multiple fronts. Scaled up initiative, incentive programs, new and revised regulations, public outreach, awareness campaigns, innovative climate finance, workforce development, investments in affordable housing in low to moderate income communities, research and development, coordinated utility planning, and more. And I'm going to take a breath there because that was more than a mouthful.
Yeah.
There will be cost impacts across the sector, but also benefits to public health, safety, workers, the economy, yada, yada, yada. Our work is cut out for us.
Oh, my God. Yes, absolutely. But I thought it was gratifying to see what appears to be despite the potential for, how shall I say, being co-opted into some milquetoast thing, this Clean Heat Commission, which was mandated by the Mass government, they came back with a fairly straightforward, sobering kind of response. I mean, they didn't, of course, I haven't read it. It's a big report, but I've read some of the reviews and I've scanned the executive summary, right? They're not pulling any punches, right? They say, there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen. It all needs to happen quickly. And Yeah, I think that it got released at an unfortunate time in the hurly-burly of the holidays, at least from my
Right.
perspective. But it
And
is
at the end
kind
of
of.
the and at the end of the term for our prior governor Baker, right?
That's right.
So,
Right.
yeah.
And so it's something that we should take to heart and look at the different, because there's a ton of, again, a ton of different stuff. You refer to all those different subjects, right? But there's a lot of information in there. But what I took out of it, at least the executive summary, was that the commissioners, had a sense of urgency about getting things going. And they had a sense that the Massachusetts state government needs to work to align itself better, to identify so that the different agencies are talking to each other. And they had other very specific kinds of recommendations we can get into that I thought were quite useful.
Yeah, and I think that's a good connection point because in our last session, we talked about Governor Healey and her first executive action was to create that climate lead, right? Recognizing, so at least she read the report, I think. She certainly understood that she needs to help, as we've talked a number of our sessions, where left hand, right hand, we need to be together. The Commonwealth needs to work in common towards this goal. And in the paragraph, which again comes from that executive summary, yeah, they weren't sugarcoating it there. And it was interesting because clearly this is effectively the first report. And it was only 2021 that the roadmap was set. So this is a year later. They were still talking of future and work to be done. They were not talking of accomplishments, right? Which in itself is significant. And thereby, oh, by the way, we do have a boatload of work.
Well, I mean, I think to your point, just, it's easy to say things like the state government needs to be aligned, right? The different agencies, it's hard to translate that into a real thing. But I'm looking at a commentary from the Arcadia Center, and the thing that they said is that there's a need for joint energy system planning. Okay, and they say that the DPU, which is the Department of Public Utilities, and the DOER, the Department of Energy, oh my God, resources,
Resources,
energy
I think.
resources,
Yeah.
they need to conduct a statewide joint energy system planning. And what do they mean by joint energy? They say, look, if the gas system is going to go away, right? The electricity system is going to grow to replace it, and somebody needs to be making those connections between those two things so we don't end up with a gap somewhere. And
Sure.
that's what I think they mean by coordinated planning, that right? If we have one organization that's trying to ramp up the creation of green electricity and another organization that's trying to ramp down the use of natural gas, they need to be in alignment. And that's a very specific kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I concur because we've talked about the infrastructure requirements in terms of the pipelines and the power lines. And ISO New England in specific has kind of that charter. So there needs to be coordination, not just within the government, but with ISO in order to make those coordinations that as we shift from a fossil-based or a natural gas-based, we know natural is not the right word for it, to whether it's wind energy or solar energy, that we can do that accommodation relatively seamlessly so the electricity flows right through to the plugs when we need it. And that will require coordination.
I think the other useful word that fell out of that convoluted sentence you read, right? The first sentence of legalese boilerplate in the commission's report, they talked about decarbonization, right? Which
Decarbonization. Yep.
sounds like a chemistry process, but I think what they really mean is the replacement of systems that emit carbon dioxide, that is to say, burn fossil fuels to do stuff, right? To remove those systems, to decarbonize the system and replace that, whatever that fossil fuel is being used to do, with electricity. And of course, the most easiest to grasp example would be to decarbonize your home in
Right.
the sense that you get rid of the methane gas that you're heating your hot water and heating your house with, right? And replace that with electrical heat pumps. So that's decarbonization of a home. You've got decarbonization of the transportation system, where you want to get cars becoming electrified, electric cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have decarbonization right. of the energy generation, where you get rid of the coal plants and make your electricity with wind. So decarbonization sounds fancy, but it's really the kind of the whole process of trying to replace the fossil fuels with clean energy. And typically that's electricity, right?
Clean Agreed. Electricity. And it tying into the next link that's in the show notes in terms of the Boston Foundation Climate Report Card, which was also issued in November of 2022 and thereby tended to get lost in the holidays, et cetera. They reemphasize across the four transportation, housing, et cetera, it was interesting to look back in the commission's report. They focused first on the housing sector, potentially to our discussion that we, who are the little folk in the housing space, we're going to need assistance. We're going to need help and guidance, and never mind some financial resources potentially, but at least, you know, that needs to be a focus. So if anything, kudos to the report writers. They didn't credit the wind and solar and other things, which we've discussed, are indeed making progress. They focused on the housing and commercial residential areas as really being the next area of focus. So yeah, that I think was pretty good. And again, it's work we need to do rapidly, and it's going to cost us. Oh, by the way.
So for example, the commission to that end of the little, I mean, number one, Steve, you and I and everybody listening to this podcast are at the same sort of mindset of these people writing the commission report, mm-hmm. right? They're worried about tracking the roadmap. But one of the things that the Commission on Heat discussed, which I think pertains to people like you and I and everybody listening, is that the state of Massachusetts needs to do a better job of having one-stop shopping, so to speak, to help people decarbonize their homes.
Yes.
That we've talked a lot about Mass Save. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But the idea that now with the Inflation Reduction Act at the federal level, there are multiple ways you can get money for the things you want to do, to understand what you have to do, et cetera, et cetera. The state needs to streamline that process so that a person like myself can go make one phone call and find out what are my options, what can I do, and who can I talk to about following through on that without worrying about talking to five different agencies, right?
Yeah, and then clearly the other big key piece in there was related to the decarbonization was net zero, right? And net zero, and I'll pull a quote from another source that I'll expand upon as we go forward. But the quote, numbers are an element in a narrative process, but they are not just an element. When we have a number, it tends to take on a special importance as it leaves to us all the heavy lifting of the narrative construction. Yet it constrains that construction because the story we tell has to justify the number. They're kind of tied together. Your quantified data history can provide material for constructing a story, but here our language also betrays us. We talk about the output from our tracking programs as results, but they're not results. They are first steps. And too often they are first steps that don't suggest second steps. Right? So Sherry Turkle wrote that from her book, Reclaiming Conversations, 2015 book, just started reading it. It provides so much insight in terms of what I'm trying to do here in terms of making sense of climate with your help. And that's where it kind of, she references also Henry David Thoreau. We remember him. He was a Massachusetts resident long time ago, Walden Pond, all that kind of good stuff. He had a concept of three chairs. His house had three chairs. The first chair was for the individual, so that you in your house with your chair, me in my house with my chair, we would sit and think, maybe read, but sit in solitude and thereby help to deal with the world. And I know from the preparation that I do for these sessions, and I'm sure you do very similarly because of the notes we're passing back and forth between, you have some similar approach to that. The second chair is kind of the conversation that you and I have here specifically because we're friends, but then individually with our families and our other circles of friends, that's the second chair, right? And the third chair is our visitor, the listeners, that outside the circle person who we want to draw into the conversation. Because as it turns out, while I may be making sense of it for me, unless we get more involved, that rapidly moving that the Commonwealth Commission's report said, it's not going to happen. And oh, by the way, we know it's not going to be an easy road because, as you just said, we don't have an easy way to get there, right? We've got conflicting things here and there. So we've got a lot to do.
Well, that's an interesting metaphor. Basically, this conversation that you and I are having now is, in a sense, being eavesdropped, overheard by the listeners. Thank you all very much for listening out there in Radio Land. Right? Mm-hmm. But the point is to draw in and help other people understand their own circumstances. And I guess I can only hope that that's functioning. So if anyone's listening and getting lost in the weeds or this is not satisfying, right? We want to know, because the whole point is sharing what I think is knowledge or the understanding. And I guess then it becomes not incumbent, but the people who I think are listening to the show are in their own seat, right?
Yes.
In their own private seat. And we are, in some sense, this show is in some sense part of their research, right?
Yes.
And then they get to reach out to their own audience. And that's an extremely important kind of function as well. Is that this sort of multiplier effect of people, and I can use another funky word, of normalizing the discussion of climate, that, yeah, you can talk about it. It may not be easy to do because it often makes you the Cassandra in the situation or the buzzkill, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you, the more facility you have with the topic, the easier it is to bring it up. And the fact that if we all just accepted the fact that this was happening, then the action would be imperative. Right. And so that's right. And that's the direction that you think we're going. Would you agree?
And it was interesting because reading the book allowed me to verbalize a little bit better about exactly, I think, what we are trying to do. And yes, while we started right from the beginning, you're helping me make sense of climate. That's one thing. And clearly, each in our own way, we can make sense of the climate. But the bigger issue in terms of the rapid work that needs to be done is getting others involved to at least come to the table, start listening, be aware of the terminology, and then start asking the questions, well, how does it, what do I need to do? What can I do? Is it an electric vehicle? Is it a hybrid vehicle? Is it, you know, geothermal? Is it heat pumps? Or a nice segue comes here in terms of the appliances, in particular, you know, the dishwashers, where, you know, we were brought up in our age where you pre-washed or at least rinsed the thing before the dish or the pan before you put it into the dishwasher. And that's not actually the best thing to do, we're finding out.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about teaching an old dog new tricks, I mean, I'm still struggling with that. But yeah, there's it turns out that. So to go back to the three chair analogy you were talking about, I think that the listening to podcasts like this allow people to understand what their role is, right? And I made the case that everyone has a role in addressing climate change, right? Some people are Greta Thunberg. Some people make podcasts. Some people get arrested, right? Everyone has their own path,
mm-hmm.
right? But the place to begin is recognizing that there is an issue and that you are part of it, right? And then you can search around. It will happen naturally that people understand where their sweet spot is, right, for taking action. And oftentimes the place that most people begin is with things that they can personally control, right? It's like you can't worry about the hole in the ozone layer, you know, in the first instance, right? No. You look around and say, right, yeah. Is my life consistent with these things that I'm hearing, right? Am I sort of aligned with that or opposed to that? And your home is a very easy place just to begin thinking about it, right? And so that leads you to this idea of the appliances in your home as being the source of the first actions. And I made the case that once you begin to take two or three climate actions, all of a sudden you see yourself as a climate activist and your self-perception changes, right? So, I mean, the article, so there's an article, right, about myths about appliances.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, now that I read it, it makes sense. I walk around turning out light bulbs. I did that for years and years, right?
Sure.
Because the light bulb, the old-fashioned incandescent light bulb, was essentially a heating source that produced a small amount of light as a byproduct, right? And in fact, it was craziness that a light bulb was rated by the power it consumed, not how much light it gave out, right? It's just, so you had a 60-watt bulb. Okay, you thought that was a certain brightness, but anyway,
It's not the lumens that are now the label.
Exactly.
It was the wattage. It was how much power we were using.
But nowadays, many people, in fact, have switched over to the more efficient light, the LEDs. They're commonplace. No one, right? The sun still comes up in the morning, even though you have LED lights in your home, mm-hmm. right? People used to be afraid about the nice warm glow of the incandescent light. How would that, would ruin the ambiance of my household? Well, you have blue LED, reddish LEDs. You get all that. The world goes on, right?
The variety of LEDs is itself, we could do a separate piece, but that's even in our ballpark.
It turns out that lighting is now a relatively small fraction of the energy consumed in your home.
Right.
So if you're still running around with incandescent bulbs, sure, switch them out. Right? But then I think the article recommends that the place to look is at your appliances as the first instance, and that the big energy hogs are the dishwasher and the refrigerator. Those are the ones you interact with daily.
Right.
Right. And there's a story to tell there, right? So, Steve, what was this? This brings us back to, do you scrape the dishes off and wash them before you put them in the dishwasher? Or do you say, by jingo, that dishwasher is going to do all the work for me? Well, what's your feel?
I'll be able to tell better the next time we talk. Only not to dissuade, not to answer. I will answer, but I'll be in a better position to answer shortly. Habits are habits. I've grown up rinsing before putting into the dishwasher. Coincidentally, a new dishwasher was delivered today. With a little bit of luck, a new dishwasher will be installed on Thursday. So I'll test it. I will try and go that way. I can understand the point of the article and the science, if you will, the studies that have been done around it, because if you're going to rinse and you're going to just leave the faucet open to do your rinsing, you're obviously wasting a bunch of water there. And if it's hot water, that's one thing. If it's cold water, well, it's still wasting water to do the rinsing. If you've got a two sink environment, that you can fill up one sink and rinse in the other, and that kind of works, etc. But there's also a time effort involved too, right? By pre-washing all the dishes, that's just like extra time that you don't need to take, because theoretically the machines should do it for you.
I think the argument is the following, that many people, as I said, including people I love, just turn on the hot water, stream the hot water, mm-hmm. and then sort of dip dishes underneath it, rinse them off, and then put the dishes into the dishwasher.
Right.
And at least my faucet I guess we have reasonable water pressure, but you can time it out. It runs about 1 gallon a minute. It takes about a minute to fill up a gallon of, so, you know, a gallon a minute you're consuming by just streaming hot water. So if you spend 10 minutes rinsing dishes before you put them in the dishwasher, you've consumed 10 gallons of hot water, right? Which is actually, you think about how long it would take to heat 10 gallons on your stovetop, right? That's a lot. Right? Sure. And then you do the dishes. Then you turn on the dishwasher. And the claim is that the dishwasher uses about 3 gallons of water, of hot water.
Yes, right? So significantly less.
Significantly less. And that the, at least the modern dishwashers, okay, the modern dishwashers, like the one I'm assuming you're about to get, has a little, basically it shines, has a little flashlight that shines across the back through the water as it's spraying around. And another little receptor measuring the lumens, shall we, the mm-hmm. amount of light that gets across the, and as the junk in the water goes away, the washing machine is smart enough to know that the dishes are clean.
Right.
Okay. And that makes it more efficient to simply put dirty dishes into the dishwasher, let it run. The dishwasher is smart enough to figure out when the dishes are clean, and you can take your time and go watch a basketball game or something.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yep. Or listen to a podcast.
Or listen to a podcast. But I guess I have to admit, I kind of enjoy rubbing my hands around in that hot, greasy water, cleaning things off. And I sort of take the Zen moment of cleaning up after dinner. I mean, I'm not really counting those minutes as lost time, right?
No.
I don't know. Yeah. I just don't know.
No, and clearly I want to be clear too. I wouldn't advise, you know, putting the entire dish with whatever leftovers are on the plate into the dishwasher. Yeah, that's not the intent. Yeah. But clearly, yeah, you know, put the bones and what other refuse into the garbage disposal or into the compost pile or whatever. And then whatever's food items, little juices, whatever's left on the plate, not rinsing that and putting that in the dishwasher. That'll be the test about to happen in the Sherlock household fairly soon. So I'll come back with an update in the next episode. But
So in my instance, I forget. Our dishwasher is probably less than 10 years, but more than 6 or 7.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if it is smart enough to meet these modern behavioral things, right? So when's the cutoff that says, yeah, you've got a modern enough one that you can put in a bunch of a bunch of junk? But the other, let me do the other topic there. So the other big ticket thing to think about if you're a homeowner, a person listening to this podcast, wondering where to begin thinking about things, the other interesting question is the refrigerator. In fact, what the article says is if you have a second refrigerator in the basement, it's probably old, it's probably empty pretty much, and you should just, you know, one easy thing to do is get rid of that. But that modern refrigerators are quite, again, modern, we got to figure out what that means, right? But modern refrigerators are quite efficient. And that's an easy way to cut your energy consumption as opposed to changing out the light bulbs, right? That this is another way. And of course, the good news, I think, is that I think that under the Inflation Reduction Act, that President Biden and all passed, I think there are rebates for some of that stuff, right? So in this day and age, you can start to buy these appliances that are quite energy efficient and get some money back for and take advantage of those tax dollars that are flowing back to the state.
Yeah, and that also gives us an opportunity to refer back as well to Mass Save. So if you do have incandescent bulbs, set up a Mass Save energy audit, and you can get a bunch of that, whether bulb replacement, there usually is a variety of bulbs they'll just come in and bring, and variety of LEDs for different outlets that you have, different lighting fixtures, because there are a variety of fixtures in the houses in most cases, especially in the older houses. You have older fixtures with either wide bases or narrow bases. And as you've seen, sometimes the light bulbs are different. You can't always put every light bulb into the same socket. So the one thing on Mass Save. Secondly, within that, yes, it's always good to check on what rebates are available. And that will help minimize the cost. Obviously, there's still going to be an upfront cost, but in some cases, you can get, you know, whether it's financing or whatever, look at the life cycle in terms of if you're going to get, call it a $50 rebate, $75 rebate, and get something on sale, then maybe the return, including the savings on electrical usage, you know, maybe gives you a 2-year return, 3-year return,
right,
as opposed to a longer one. So,
since you said Mass Save again, I got to wander back to Mass Save one a third time. So just to remind everybody, Mass Save is an organization that is mandated by the state government, but run by the utilities, right? Run by the utilities. And Mass Save traditionally over the last 10 or 15 years has been trying to improve your energy efficiency, even though that was somewhat at odds with the profit motive of the utilities, right?
Sure.
They were kind of in competition with each other. The Clean Heat Commission report says that Mass Save, that the state legislature should redefine Mass Save as a kind of a clearinghouse that is independent of the utilities, right? So you don't have this funny conflict about who's trying to do what, and make Mass Save responsible for cutting carbon dioxide and basically be the sort of one-stop shopping. So you can call up and find out, oh, the Inflation Reduction Act from the federal government, I can get X dollars if I replace my refrigerator.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's what we need, is this sort of information to be readily available to people when they come up to that moment that they decide they want a new refrigerator, and that they can get some help with it. And so it's an interesting alignment from, you know, the state level, even the federal level, down to decisions you're making in your home.
Yeah. And continuing on that theme, in our couple of our prior episodes, we referenced having our state rep, Jeff Roy, with us. One of the things that he incorporated, and I think we discussed in those episodes as well, was legislatures, both Senate and House bills fostering the climate change initiatives, have incentives for more training, et cetera, as well as in Mass Save space to provide. And I know we've talked as well, there's a pilot in that geothermal space that is underway. And as those pilot results come out, theoretically, that'll be another initiative that'll come in to help those who can take advantage of that particular circumstance. And I think, as we were discussing as well, in some cases, maybe that's not going to be everybody's going to be able to take advantage of it, but at least if we can get a significant piece of that housing market to start making that rabbit change, to go back to what the commission said, away from fossil into electric, into geothermal or, you know, heat pumps, then we'll be better off down the road. So
one other thing I would want to say, since we're on this topic, this sort of crossover of appliances that you can get, myths about appliances, and personal action, right? Because you're sort of tying those two together, right?
Yeah.
This is what you can do, dear listener. You could get a new refrigerator. Most people, you know, buying a new refrigerator is a once every 10-year kind of thing for most people, right? You don't do it a lot. And so I guess that I would say that there are other more immediate cost-free opportunities of things you can do. And I just put out there, one of those things is, forget the refrigerator, just skip the meat meal, you know, eat one less meat meal a week, right? Because of the climate implications of particularly of eating red meat are significant. And no one's asking you to become a vegan, right? And to forego all meat. I'm just saying, eat one less plate of red meat per week, and you will be doing something, you will, which is a not insignificant something that people can do long before you worry about your refrigerator, right?
Because I think going back to that key point that while you and I are making sense of climate, getting others involved, and climate to a certain extent is, as I started with, it can be overwhelming. Where do I begin? Right. Well, we have to recognize at least that we individually can make an impact, and some impacts may be easier, some impacts may be less, but we can make an impact. So I certainly.
And that impact is a journey. Right.
Oh.
You begin with smaller things.
Right.
And then as you sort of feel you develop a comfort and your own style in addressing the climate issue, it can burgeon into all sorts of different things. Right. It's this comes back to the roadmap analogy we have. Right. And you were talking about narratives. I mean, this is all a story we're telling ourselves about where we got to get to and how we're going to get there, and trying to keep the coherence, right? I mean, so if you eat one less meat meal, one less plate of red meat a week, that's good, right? But I mean, that's kind of the beginning. That's something that you do to test the water, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, that was a good recap. We can pause, I think, and let people digest what we've said, because hopefully they're sitting in that third chair that we've pulled up and they've gotten nice and comfy to listen. And then they can follow the show notes and follow some other links. We do include other links that we won't get to today, but are other updates along the way of other things that are going on here and there around the world in terms of climate. And again, we're just trying to focus on Franklin because that's where we are. So thank you again, Ted, for this conversation today, and I look forward to our next one.
I'm looking forward to having all three chairs around the fireplace sometime soon.
Absolutely. And quick reminder, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
So there you go. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.